Hello, writers. I am Grant Faulkner, one half of the Right-Minded Show. Brooke gets the week off this week because I did a special interview with Allie Benjamin, whose YA novel, The Thing About Jellyfish, was nominated for a National Book Award. And what's interesting about Allie is that after becoming a successful YA writer, she leapt into the world of adult fiction with her recently released novel, The Smash-Up, which she drafted during NaNoWriMo 2018, by the way. And it's a really great novel that sheds light on the times we're living in now. The novel tells the story of a family whose quiet, content rural life is rocked by the culture wars and a breezy, devil-may-care house guest. Watch out for those devil-may-care house guests, by the way. The New York Times called it exhilarating and mesmerizing and chose the book for its group text selection. People magazine called The Smash Up a cross between Ethan Wharton and Where'd You Go, Bernadette? And the Ethan Wharton reference speaks to the fact that The Smash Up uses Wharton's Ethan Frome as a model. And I talked to Allie about the novel and also about her writing process and her experience with NaNoWriMo. And she has had a really interesting journey as a writer, one that should inspire people who realize they were writers later in life. We talked about how an external and especially a political event affects people personally. We talked about our preferences for revising over drafting. We talked about Allie's favorite writing advice, and we talked about much, much more, of course. So this is a really interesting interview because we got to do a deep dive into a writer's process. So I hope you enjoy it. Thank you, Allie. Thank you for writing this wonderful book.
Hey, which, thanks for being here.
Just so everybody knows, we're going to talk about Allie's creative process and the writing that went into this. We're going to talk about the book itself as well. But I thought for attendees to get to know you, Allie, it'd be great to know more about your writing journey. You know, were you born a writer, or did you figure out that you were a writer later on in life? Or tell us the story.
So it's interesting because I didn't know I was a writer. Well, any job I ever had, I always wound up being the person who would like tell the story. If it's the story of the organization, kind of, you know, in the sort of public relations or marketing, or if we were trying to, like, I worked for a communications firm. So there was a lot of like trying to figure out like, okay, what are we going to do on this campaign? What are we going to do on this campaign? And I would do a lot of that thinking. But I never considered myself a writer. Sometimes I talk to school groups and I tell school groups that I always kind of thought writers were like wizards in Harry Potter. Like there was, you know, you get your invitation to be one. And if you never got your invitation, it means you weren't one. I got really, the way I got into it was I got fired from a job. I had worked for a health system here in Western Massachusetts. It's rural healthcare. It's, you know, struggling healthcare. And I lost the hospital. It was sort of affiliated with a hospital that eventually closed. I lost one boss after another. And then one day somebody came in and the hospital had been taken over by consultants. And they said, you know, this kind of, the top consultant wants to meet with you. And I was like, oh God. Oh, okay. I was pregnant at the time. Second daughter. It was not a great time to be looking for a job. We live in this area where there really aren't a lot of jobs in general. And I was like, what am I going to do? And I realized like, okay, I always was the person who did the writing for different companies. So maybe I can hire myself out as a freelance writer. And I did that for several years. And everything I did, I was like, okay, that's working. Let me see if I can get some bylines for myself. So I did some writing for academic publications, for like college alumni magazines. And I was like, okay, that worked. I wonder if I could do this next thing. And eventually it was, I wonder if I could get my name on the cover of a book. And then I wonder if I could write my own book. And it was, I kind of fell into it. I'm sort of an accidental writer, but I don't know. I do tell people like all those years of sort of business writing, I think really did hone my ability to narrow things down to the point and to eliminate weight. Like I wrote in bullet points for a number of years, you know, and you try to make each bullet point as concise as possible. Anyway, so accidental, but here I am.
I always say the best things in life are what happened accidentally. You know, I think NaNoWriMo kind of happened accidentally, to tell you the truth. That's what the founder says. And I think it's a good lesson that when you get fired, to realize that this is the moment your dreams are actually going to be realized.
Sure.
So, you know, thank that consultant who invited you. And that's a fascinating journey through business writing to novel writing, I think. And one part of that journey is, and this fascinates me, is that you were, like, usually with NaNoWriMo, we specialize more in the beginning writer or somebody who's really, you know, developing that discipline and really working on their writing chops. And then some people become, you know, wonderfully best-selling authors. But you were already a very successful author. You had been nominated for a National Book Award. And then you did NaNoWriMo, which is a rarity to have it go in that direction. Yeah, I mean, every once in a while, there'll be a published author who does NaNoWriMo. And we have a lot of our authors who do NaNoWriMo and then publish. They'll kind of do their own private NaNoWriMos or, you know, do it with us in November as well. But to have somebody, I've kind of already made it as a successful author.
I'll bet more to it, I think. Yeah, so... my friend Alexis Shaitkin, she and I did a book event last week. She wrote Saint X, which is a fantastic book. Like, she and I did it this past year. And we, you know, neither of us are logged in under our actual name because really we don't want the world to see like our public failure if we don't make it. But and every day we would sort of text each other. Here's what I did. I'll bet more do it.
Cool. You know. Well, why did you decide to do it in 2018? Was that your first NaNoWriMo? I'll prompt this a little bit before we got on the webcast. Allie was saying how this book was her affair rather than the book she was married to. So if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
So that comes from Elizabeth Gilbert. There's sort of the project that you're supposed to be working on. That's like, you know, that's sort of where your head is supposed to be going. And then very often when you have that going on, you have this sort of pull of your heart in a different direction. And I was working on a book that was my have-to book. I was under contract for it. And I have to say, like, I love the book that I wrote while under contract. That's The Next Great Pauly Fink. Like, I love the kids in that book. I love the energy of that book. But just the fact that it was under contract sort of, it gets me thinking about other things. I don't know what that is. And I conceived of, I think it was March of 2018 that I conceived of this book, and I jotted down some scenes and I'm like, okay, but this isn't what I'm supposed to be working on. And I would get pulled back to the project I was supposed to be working on, but it really kind of noodled around in my head. And then even when that was done, I still wasn't putting words down. And that was the appeal of NaNoWriMo. I don't know any writer. I mean, I'm sure there are some. I don't know anyone who doesn't struggle to just put the butt in the chair and take a blank page and turn it into words. I really struggle with that constantly. Just sit down and do the work. And I, you know, I'll do research, which feels like writing.
Oh, love research.
Writing. Like you can do all these things that sort of feel productive, but they're not putting words down. I literally, the book that is right next to me here is Chris Bailey's The Productivity Project. And I'm like, through his exercises just to make myself sit down. And that's the appeal of NaNoWriMo. Like, you sit down and you write 1600 words every day. And even if you don't know what you're going to write, you can write nonsense. But sometimes in that nonsense, you know, something comes out and you're like, oh, actually, that's not such nonsense. I could work with that. And it's a way of gathering momentum around a project, I think.
You mentioned that you have a friend who you swap word counts with. How would you describe yourself and how you participate in a writing community and what that community gives you?
So I've got a group of writer friends where we meet generally once a month. Now on Zoom, but generally in person. But what we talk about isn't like we don't share work. It's not a writer's group that, you know, we're all writers. We're all kind of working on our own thing. But we talk about, I don't know, the process of writing and the business of writing and the business of putting a book out into the world and some of those things, which actually take up a fair amount of mind share. And Alexis and I do the same thing. We don't really read each other's work. No, I'm a pretty solitary writer. And part of that is just because I can look at something and just know that it's not working. And And it's all terrible until it's not terrible. Like, you know, it's sort of like, yeah. You know, still terrible. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, this kind of works. So actually, you never really know that it works.
I'm trying to know.
Make this any better. Like, I've sort of run out of ideas, but.
Yeah, that's funny. And so I'm just going to hazard an assumption here based on what you just said. So I like asking people, I find it's like either people love rough drafting and hate revising, or they love revising and they hate drafting. And I don't know why the two. I've never talked to somebody who likes drafting and revising. So what would you choose if you could? I'm going to guess that you're a reviser. You're in the revision camp.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, it's much easier when you're starting with words. Like, you can sort of see, like, oh, I know how to fix that. I know how to fix that. I know how to fix that. But going from, you know, absolutely nothing to something that you can work with, that's a tall order.
I know. It really is. I hate it. That's why I like NaNoWriMo's. It gets me through that horrible process of writing the first draft, because I can revise forever. I'm curious. So the other big question, and I think I know the answer to this one too. Can I just keep guessing as if I'm a writer?
I love it. Yes.
I'll have my tarot cards here. But, you know, like some people are, well, we have this NaNoWriMo kind of continuum. Either you're a pantser or your planner or your planter, somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to guess that you're a pantser leaning to a planter. A planter.
I'm much more of a pantser, I think. Yeah. Than anything.
That's
that
what I was thinking, yeah.
And so, like, I'll use this book as an example. So when I did NaNoWriMo, I wasn't writing a book in order. I was writing scenes. Like, I knew I had these characters in my head. And I'll just super quickly for people who don't know. So this is in some ways a retelling of Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton, which she wrote in 1911. It's a novella, very simple, very spare story, a love triangle, a small town love triangle. A man, his really cranky, sickly witch of a wife, and the younger woman who comes to take care of her. He falls in love with the younger woman. He is trapped by circumstance. And so mine takes this family and sort of this dynamic and takes them out of the simple 1911 and drops them down in 2018. It's set during the week of the Kavanaugh hearings and incorporates everything that was going on at that time, Trump and Trumpism and Kavanaugh and Me Too and all these different things. So it kind of inverts this very spare story. And now that I've said that, I've forgotten what Panzer versus
Panzer. Yeah.
Yeah, so and for people, so there's plotters who sort of figure out what the plot is and then they write it. And then there's pantsers that are just flying by the seat of their pants. And so I knew I had these characters. I knew I was sort of taking these characters that I met in 1911, Starkfield, Massachusetts, and I was dropping them into our contemporary world. I sort of knew enough about them, sort of, but I needed to come up with their stories and sort of what happened. And I knew I had to get from the sort of initial setup, which is a man who's sort of trapped between these two, you know, and it's sort of a bit of a cliche of a story, the married man, middle-aged man who falls in love with the younger woman and can't be with his true heart, right? And so I kind of had that almost cliche of a story to begin with. And I knew I had to get to the eventual smash-up. And I knew it needed to be a contemporary version of kind of what unfolds in Ethan Frome. And I didn't know how. But I had these characters, and so I would write these scenes with characters. There's one scene where Zoe, the wife, experiences some road rage. And that kind of gets some elements of the plot. It sort of gets them moving with their own momentum. But that originally, it was just this isolated scene that I had written that I had no idea where it fit. So it's almost like what I have is an index card. And then there's another scene where she's got her women's resistance group that, you know, they're sort of fighting Trumpism and Trump. And Ethan walks in and finds his living room just taken over by sort of, you know, these women and their pink hats and their furious signs. And I didn't know where that went. And there's a scene where they go to their daughter's sort of very twee private school, and they have an altercation with another parent. And I didn't know where that goes. And so then I'm like, okay, well, what if the altercation is the thing that gets her amped up so that she has the road rage? And I just kind of figure out how they go together and, you know, try to string them together with as little connective tissue as possible, because what people really want are those scenes that feel like they have the juice. Yeah, so that's pretty pantsy, I'd say.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm especially interested. I think it's actually brave to write about an external event that's like so current, even though the Kavanaugh hearings now feel like ancient history. But I think, you know, we all experience that so deeply. And so you wrote this about the Kavanaugh hearings. You wrote, "There are no closed off spaces. It turns out the rupturing, the quake could be felt in every floorboard, in every home. There wasn't a window anywhere that hadn't been rattled. Even here in this quiet nowhere, what happened had fractured even the quietest of lies." So can you tell us more about situating your story within such a fraught national experience? And then after you answer this, and maybe even before you want to answer this, I'd love if you could read from the beginning of the book, because I think that beginning, those beginning pages really, really capture that moment in history of the Trump election.
Okay. I will read first, and then you may need to remind me of the question.
Okay, good.
Okay. This is from the introduction. What happened? Everyone asked the question, had been asking since the election. They asked while watching the news, that storm of headlines, jump cut footage of marches and speeches and hand sharpied cardboard, an endless swirling blizzard, a siege really, of protests and counter protests, action and reaction, people screaming at one another in the street, neighbor versus neighbor, friend versus friend, or too often friends no more. We were in new territory. People had their limits. What happened? Reporters asked in small town diners over $7.50 lunch specials, BLTs cut into neat wedges, Heinz bottles perched like microphones atop scratched Formica tables. What happened? People asked one another in church basements, community centers, gyms, coffee shops, living rooms, where they came together to weep, process, scrawl on placards, plan the revolution. What happened? Parents snapped off NPR mid-story, not wanting to answer questions from the back seat. College students organized walkouts, staged sit-ins, blocked freeways. A giant inflatable chicken appeared behind the White House lawn, some sort of protest that no one entirely understood. Everything was some sort of protest now. What happened? What happened? What happened? What? Everyone had their answers, and as is generally the case in these situations, everyone's version of the story was a little different. I'll stop there.
I love that, because that's absolutely true. We experienced it all together, and yet we all have a different version. And I love how what happened, the question just like is like a heartbeat through those first pages, you know, like we can explain it over and over again, and we still have to ask the question, what happened? Yeah. Yeah, and I love later how you trace it to an earthquake, which doesn't happen in a moment. It takes place over hundreds of years.
Yeah, it feels like it's this one dramatic event, but actually it's this thing that's been happening slowly over time.
Yeah.
Then all at once. That's
yeah, exactly. It's a perfect metaphor. Well, my question was like, so I've actually, I think, I don't know if I remember this exactly. I went and got my MFA years ago, and it just seems like MFA programs dissuade writers from writing about any, like situating a story within a current event. You know, I think there's a certain riskiness to that. Like either people want to escape or there's just, you know, you're writing in within such constraints of the time period, I guess. So what was it like to write within this national event? Like, I can remember the event so well. I remember where I was sitting watching those hearings. I remember the whole day really vividly. And I think that's because it was traumatic, right?
Yeah. So I got the idea for the book, and I wrote some of those scenes before the Kavanaugh hearings. And then the Kavanaugh, and you know, what I wanted to do, the original Ethan Frome, there's all of this nature sort of that's like you know, rattling the windows of the homes. There's blizzards. It's the cruelest of winters. And, you know, you get this sense of like they're so stuck in the cold and in sort of braving the natural elements. And I wanted what was happening, the national scene, sort of Trump, everything that was sort of unfolding around us. And it was, you know, every hour, every minute, there was some new horror. It was like an endless, it was just the endless scroll of really terrible things. I wanted that to sort of be the storm, the blizzard, the cold. But the Kavanaugh hearings hadn't happened yet when I wrote what I just read, actually. But when the Kavanaugh hearings happened, I mean, when they happened, I wasn't thinking about this book at all. I was just experiencing it. And it was only when it was over, I thought like, wow, this is really this distillation of everything that we're seeing. This, you know, we're sort of elevating these individuals to symbols that we can just project what we believe or don't believe onto them. We are, you know, there was a sense of just being rolled over, like it sort of didn't matter. It sort of, what was going to happen, it was going to happen. And it just felt like this crystallization of something that had been almost too general to set a novel in. You know, it unfolded over this specific period of time, so I could set the novel in the specific period of time. I could sort of, you know, there's a moment in the book where the characters are actually watching the Kavanaugh hearings, and you're sort of watching it in real time with the characters. And it's such a specific, I don't need to say what it is. Everybody knows what it is. We were all there. We all know what happened. And so I can really focus just on the interactions between the characters as this thing is on TV in their living room. I don't know, like it just felt so right. There's a lot of risk to writing about current events, you know, and there was a lot of risk to this book. I had no idea, like, you know, the book sold in September 2019. And, you know, I had to turn in that final draft by May of 2020. I don't even know if we had a Democratic nominee at that point. Like we had no idea. Yeah, we had no idea what was going to happen. And like, it was out of my hands. And so there was this giant black box for what was going to happen in between my finishing the book and the book coming out in the world. And I had like, that's a really risky thing where you're like, okay, so let me just find what the truth is as best as I know how to tell it, regardless of the, like what unfolds and how it unfolds. Let me just find like, what are the core questions of this time and kind of frame the book around those. Yeah. But yeah, I can see why people would not recommend it. but it was also really cathartic to write it. It was a way for me to make sense. It was a way for me to make sense of it while also creating moments for myself that were like, you know, letting the pressure out, like letting that release valve go. You know, the scenes were really fun for me to write. And I think it was probably as much what I needed during that time.
I wanted to ask you about the influence of Edith Wharton's 1911 novella, Ethan Frome. And I'm going to read this commentary by the LA Times reviewer who remarked, "As I reread Ethan Frome in preparation for this review, I find myself admiring Wharton's sumptuous descriptions and her ability to infuse every moment with a sense of inexorable tragedy. But I also wondered, who the hell would want to retell this story in a contemporary setting?" So now you get to answer that question. Why did you want to retell this story?
I've told this story before, but it actually came to me. I was sledding with my daughter, which if you know, you don't have to have read Ethan Frome to read this book. This book stands on its own. If you have read Ethan Frome, if you know it, like you'll find some Easter eggs in there, but it's meant to be a totally independent piece of work. But I had gone sledding with my daughter, which sledding is a big part of the original Ethan Frome. There's kind of a big moment that involves sledding. And it was a particularly hazardous sledding path we were going down. And I said to my daughter, hey, this reminds me of a book I read in high school. I hadn't read it since high school. I read it when I was 15 years old. I was a pissy sophomore in high school who just, you know, wanted to be let out so I could drive around with my friends in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful book. It's a very depressing book. It's really a bleak book. She is known for her satire. I think The Smash Up is much more satirical. It's much more in line with some of those other books. Ethan Frome is just tragic in every way. And I started telling my daughter the story of this tragic book. And I said, you know, so there's this man, Ethan, he's a farmer, he's poor, he's married to this woman who's just awful. She's old and she's mean and she's really snappish. And as the words are coming out of my mouth, I realized that, like, if I had anything in common with any character in that original book, it was that wife, Zenobia Frome. And that was kind of this big moment. You know, you have these kind of like, wait a minute, how have I become this? Immediately my mind went to starting to defend Zenobia, who, you know, was indefensible when I read her when I was 15. I was like, maybe she was angry. Maybe she was going to be angry. And then from that moment, it was just like, ding, like, I should take these characters and I should sort of drop them down. You know, it was the middle of Me Too was happening, and I should take this sort of this story and kind of like, let's see what it looks like now. Let's see what these characters would look like now. What, you know, this very simple story, would it look so simple anymore? So that was the impetus. That was the original idea. It just seemed like it worth exploring.
I love that moment of recognizing that that's the story.
Self-recognition is not always a pretty thing.
And you told it so well. That was such a dramatic telling. You know what? While you were talking about that, I've written two novels based on some of my favorite novels. Maybe I shouldn't have done it because they're favorites, but I wrote early on in my 20s, I wrote a novel based on Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. And then I wrote another novel based on Sheltering Sky. They were both, I mean, in the end, they were both failed novels. And I think in part, I found it challenging to take this existing work, I guess, with all of its structure in place, and to kind of, I guess I was like, I mean, maybe I struggled with how much to preserve and how much to take liberties with the material, you know, because you're almost dealing with two novels at once. And did you feel that at all with Ethan Frome?
You know,
or did you make it entirely yours?
Simple. It's such a simple story. You know, there's very little action in Ethan Frome. So it was almost like I had these like cones like that I kind of had to move around, but there weren't that many of them. So that's not the part that I found challenging. And also, like, you know, there are a lot of failed novels. I have a lot of failed novels. And you don't know when you're starting if this one is going to be the failure or if this is going to be something that works. So there's a lot of freedom that comes with not really believing that it's ever going to be anything. You know,
I recommend that to every writer, actually.
Yeah,
that balance between it's not going to be anything and the delusion that it's going to win the National Book Award. Some of those two work together, I think.
I don't know, though. I feel like I can't write a thing if I think somebody is going to read it. Like, I just have to be like, I'm just writing this for me. Like, that it's thinking of those eyes that might be on it eventually. You know, it's so paralyzing. So it felt more like play. And I think if I had thought too much about, like, oh, I'm rewriting this classic and people have really strong feelings about this classic, and I'm, you know, I'm telling it in a way that's almost like the polar opposite of how Edith Wharton did it. You know, she wrote something that was simple and spare and restrained, and I am doing something that's sort of much louder, you know, that feels much more like 2018. So I don't know. I think it's the delusion that nobody will ever read it. And then, you know, it's like 2 days before it comes out in the world. And I'm like, what have I done?
Hey, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview and that you will read the Smash Up and ponder how these odd and dramatic times we're living in may influence your stories in large or small ways. Brooke and I will be back next week with our regular program. Right Minded is a weekly podcast, and we're grateful for opportunities like these to collaborate with like-minded community events. And we're grateful to you, our listeners, for making Right Minded possible. So we'll see you next week.